From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Josh Rogers. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Republican Chris Sununu and Democrat Colin Van Ostern face off in their first debate in the race for governor, ready to draw a sharp contrast.
If Chris had his way in the vote that he cast multiple times, 50,000 people today would not have their health care covered.
And Councilor Van Ostern and Maggie Hassan said, there's no time. We need to pass it right now, and then we can go read it. Exactly as Nancy Pelosi did, that is exactly not the New Hampshire way.
The New Hampshire Supreme Court considers whether details of Lizzie Marriott's sexual past, protected under the state's rape shield law during trial, should be allowed in as part of Seth Mazzaglia's appeal. Here's Mazzaglia's attorney, Chris Johnson.
To explain why the evidence should have been admitted, I have to talk about what it was.
And voters in the 1st Congressional District may be bracing themselves for Ginta Shea Porter Part 4, but a decision by the Ballot Law Commission means one-time Democrat, now independent, Sean Connor is in the race, too.
Finally, after 8 years, they will have a viable choice other than Frank Ginta and Carol Shea Porter, and I look forward to the spirited campaign ahead.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Joined this morning by Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, and Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Good morning, all. Why don't we start with politics? As noted in the open, gubernatorial candidates Chris Sununu and Colin Van Ostern debated for the first time this week. I had the privilege of being a panelist on one of those meetings that NHPR, the New Hampshire Business Review, and the BIA put on. And I would say, viewing it from the stage, both candidates acquitted themselves reasonably well. I'm assuming all of you were riveted to the debates. Did we learn anything new or see anything telling from their performances this week, Paul?
We as journalists didn't, because we've been covering this race for a while, but I think both your debate and the one the next day by the AARP of New Hampshire were great for viewers and voters, because most of them have not been tuned in to this contest. And from both of these debates, it's very clear on every issue, from Planned Parenthood to commuter rail to Medicaid expansion to minimum wage and everything in between, these two candidates don't see eye to eye. They have vast differences.
Allie, what did you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's become clear in these debates is what many of us expected. Both Chris Sununu and Colin Van Ostern sit on the 5-member executive council, which is a body I'm sure most of the public hasn't heard much about. But their voting records on that body are really becoming a central point in this race. And I think that we'll kind of see that through to November Election Day. And we do see some contrast there. You know, Colin Van Ostern has really been hammering Chris Sununu for voting against implementing a contract in 2014 to expand Medicaid to 50,000 adults. You know, Chris Sununu's retort is that they got that contract just 15 minutes before they were asked to vote on it, which he said, you know, isn't responsible to get a 100-page contract and vote on it almost immediately without reading it. So I think we'll hear some of these familiar attacks, you know, about their record together on the executive council.
So we have some tape of Colin Van Ostern going after Chris Sununu on Medicaid. And why don't we take a listen to that now?
Right now, we're running more revenues than we are costs in the state. And I think this is an area where making the successful bipartisan expansion of health care coverage, the New Hampshire Health Protection Plan, permanent is the right thing to do for strengthening our workforce and strengthening our economy. And it's critical for overcoming the drug crisis.
All right. That was Colin Van Ostern earlier this week talking about making permanent expanded Medicaid. And that he was specifically there. He was asked for, you know, how are you going to pay for it when federal funding recedes right now? Hospitals and insurance companies are picking up, I believe, currently $42 million in what have become to have been known voluntary contributions. And in 2019, that number is going to ratchet up the need for more a greater state share to, you know, north of $60 million is my understanding. And it's an open question where that money is going to come from. We tried to get Colin Van Ostern to say, you know, do you have any tax increases in mind? He said he would envision spending general fund money, but was imprecise about, you know, what in particular how a particular source of money would go to that. He said that, you know, he cited the surplus. Dean, what do you hear in Colin Van Ostern as he talks about these issues? I mean, what I hear is a lot of we can do more, we can do better. And, you know, as is traditional from Democrats running for governor who've been successful, downplaying the need for more revenue.
Yeah, interesting. A couple of initial reactions to this race. The first thing is, if you look at the two of them, they literally are similarly sized physically. They're both sort of big guys. So we sort of know physically what our next governor is going to look like. And there's something oddly comforting about that. We kind of, you know, Sununu or Van Ostern, you kind of know what it's going to look
like. BMIs are very similar.
Exactly. In fact, literally somebody said that to me over the weekend, and I think we know what our next governor is going to look like behind the podium, regardless of which gentleman it is. The other thing, a couple of other initial reactions for the debates. I think they both need to be careful to not get too much into the weeds of the executive council. I think there's a danger of a little too much insider baseball. You know, 3 years ago you voted for a certain piece of legislation, and then you voted against another one 2 years later. They got to kind of make sure that they sort of talk in kind of larger, sort of clear thematic lines, because I think a lot of this sort of insider contract stuff just kind of sounds like bickering and sort of insider baseball. So there's that as well. You know, in addition, we know that Chris Sununu has a sort of greater name recognition by virtue of his family, by virtue of the fact that he and Ted Gatzis were sort of the big story for most of the primaries, the two of them going back and forth. So I think Collins starts off with a little bit of a name disadvantage there. And the final thing is, and again, this is sort of unscientific, but talking to people over the weekend about the race, I've had several people suggest to me that, you know, Chris Sununu has this sort of, you know, the touch of sort of the everyman kind of, you know, he's sort of a regular guy, plain spoken, and the Collin can be a little bit sort of programmatic at some time. So I think that's something that something that we may see develop. But you're right. I think the history of running for governor for New Hampshire, at least recently, is to talk about, you know, kind of fiscal responsibility and not unnecessarily raising revenues and sort of finding money where maybe you didn't think there was any money. And I think it is true that, you know, if you propose a number of programs, you've got to be able to explain how you're going to pay for them. But those sort of my initial reactions on kind of the sort of the insider nature of the debate and name recognition and, you know, sort of general themes versus kind of programmatic details.
Well, as Ali mentioned, it is interesting the way in which we're getting a look at council votes and, you know, in some ways politicizing the council in a way that is at least fresh to those of us who have watched gubernatorial politics for some time. But it is interesting in the degree to which, I mean, Collin Van Ostern has a background working in campaigns and the way in which he and Democrats have mm-hmm. organized, you know, much of this week to let's talk about this part of an executive council record that, you know, we believe casts our candidate in a more positive light, be it solar energy, be it Planned Parenthood. Paul, you got any thoughts on this?
Yeah, no, I think you're all right on point here on this one. In yesterday's forum, and it was the same in yours as well, Sununu got a little agitated, a little upset, basically saying that Van Ostern was misrepresenting his record on Medicaid expansion, also on Planned Parenthood. After the forum, I had a chance to talk to both candidates, and Collin made it very clear that these votes, he said, are going to be an important part of the election going forward. And Sununu said that, again, Collin was trying to politicize these votes, and I'm going to shrug that off. We're going to hear a lot more of this. These two debates were just an appetizer.
Well, why don't we hear a little bit what Chris Sununu had to say in his debate? And this was less about the executive council record and more about a general philosophy of government, and we asked him about business taxes.
The issue at hand is doing it the New Hampshire way. Once you go down the path of making this giant Washington massively subsidized program permanent, to your point, you have to pay for it. And as that delta increases, that difference that has to be made up right now by the private sector, you look at $42 million this year, $60 million next year, you're going to hit $100, $150, $200 million. Once you make that permanent, you've lost all your leverage with the federal government in designing a system for New Hampshire people.
Okay, that was Chris Sununu. That was actually him talking about Medicaid expansion, which raises another issue that is interesting, is that, you know, it's unclear. I mean, Chris Sununu's website says one thing about his position on Medicaid expansion. If you look at it through the lens of, I want to repeal Obamacare, he gets pretty touchy if you say you want to repeal Medicaid expansion. What he says is he wants to grandfather people who now have coverage in for a period of time. You know, I don't think there's been a terribly clear answer about exactly how that would work. I mean, do you think that Medicaid expansion is going to be, you know, a dominant issue, or is this going to be more generalized, you know, philosophy of government, Republican versus Democrat, Allie?
In the race or
yeah,
coming
in
up?
Yeah, in the race.
Yeah, you know, I think it is one of many issues, but I think that, you know, Medicaid expansion, while a lot of people know about it, it affects about 50,000 people in the state. And I think that there are, you know, are some other issues, too, that they haven't been touching on as much, but that will also become major players. I mean, the opioid crisis is a big one. The economy is another, workforce training. And I think, as you mentioned, the two candidates really have different philosophies of government. And I think you see that in most of their answers. I think Chris Sununu regularly says, you know, he wants to return New Hampshire's New Hampshire advantage, you know. He hasn't really defined what that is, but that kind of is guiding his platform here when he talks about, you know, making it more business friendly, cutting regulation, that type of thing. And I think when you look at Colin Van Ostern, he's really talking about, you know, moving New Hampshire forward with investments in things like rail and expanding full day kindergarten and trying to make New Hampshire a more attractive state for people to move in.
Well, why don't we listen to what Chris Sununu said sort of on the New Hampshire Advantage front, and the New Hampshire Advantage, obviously, like, you know, it's difficult to define, but, you know, people believe they know it when they see it kind of thing. So why don't we hear what Chris Sununu said?
Absolutely, we need to keep lowering business taxes in the state. It's a successful model that was brought forth by the Senate and the House that, again, let's remember, the Democrats and the governor vetoed. I know she likes to take credit for it now, but she vetoed because she didn't like the reduction in business taxes. We need to reduce business taxes. We need to reduce business regulations. We need to get back to being a state that says we're open for business. We are job-friendly. We are business-friendly. Our high health care costs, the lack of a long-term energy plan in the state, these are all things that inhibit our ability to bring business over the border.
Okay, Chris Sununu earlier this week during the debate. And Dean, these are arguments we've heard from pretty much every Republican who's run for governor since I've been watching.
Right. As I was listening to the clip, I was thinking this is not particularly radical. This is sort of standard pro-business establishment Republican. I think this is kind of where people thought he would be, given him and his history's family in the state. And I also think Ali is right that, to some extent, the earlier clip on Medicaid expansion really is kind of a proxy for discussions of extending federal mandates, unfunded mandates. The idea that once you create a bureaucratic program, you've created a constituency for that, becomes very difficult to take that away, and then you're sort of locked into paying the money. I mean, that's been the big debate over Obamacare, particularly when it was first passed, was the idea that the federal government was going to require states to do certain things and then ramp down the funding, and then the states kind of get stuck holding the financial bag. So I think everything we're hearing in those clips from Chris Sununu is pretty much where I expect him to be, and it sounds like a general sort of pro-business republicanism that, as you said, we've heard for many years in the state.
All right, we have an email on this from Christopher from Manchester, who says he believes Chris Sununu will make a competitive race as a Republican nominee because, in Christopher's view, he can attract independents and won't alienate moderate Republicans. So that's what Christopher of Manchester thinks. Let us know what you think. Join us by phone, 1-800-892-6477, or email at exchange@nhpr.org. One thing that's interesting, we've got, like, I don't know, 50 days left, is that, you know, some of the polling out there, I know you wrote about this Monmouth poll, Paul, you know, showed it to be a little bit of a tighter race than some people might have anticipated, given the name ID edge that Chris Sununu had. You know, what was your takeaway from that poll?
Yeah, it's a 6-point race, according to Monmouth, which is pretty much right at the edge of their sampling error, with Sununu ahead by 6. Name recognition, very important there, obviously. 66% of voters couldn't make up their mind whether they had a favorable or unfavorable opinion of Van Ostern because they didn't know enough about him. That number only at 40% for Sununu. So, again, that's why the New Hampshire Democratic Party up with ads right now, kind of basically positive ads, explaining biography ads, explaining who Colin is. That's his job number one right now. The other interesting thing from that poll is independence, and Sununu did have the edge right now.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that the Republican primary for governor got so much more attention than the Democratic one that, you know, Sununu already went in with the highest name recognition, I think, of any candidate in either party based on the MUR polls in recent months. And then on top of that, you know, the story through election night was, you know, will Sununu edge out Edelblue? And before that, it was will Sununu beat Gatsis? And so he goes in with a sort of much higher visibility to begin with, and that's compounded by the family name recognition. So, you know, I think the for all of Van Ostern's strong organization among Democrats, he has to make his case to independents and to the broader electorate.
All right. Why don't we go to the phones now? We've got Keith on the line who wants to talk about another statewide race, the race for U.S. Senate between Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I was reading earlier this week that Governor Hassan, for some reason, doesn't seem to want to debate Senator Ayotte when it comes to issues of national security. I know they agreed on a couple of debates, but this one is really near and dear. I think we're really in tough times, and national security is very, very important. I find it probably to be one of the most important parts of issues regarding this election.
So, Keith, do you know how you're going to vote in this race?
I do. I'm pretty sure.
It sounds like you might be favoring Ayotte.
I am favoring Ayotte, most certainly.
And is national security a big reason why?
My son just is in the Army, and it's one of those things that I think Senator Ayotte has definitely been 100% championing the cause of the veterans and in our foreign policy.
All right, Keith, thanks for joining us. So, you know, the debate over debates is always a part of any race. You know, reporters tend to agree with varying degrees of tedium. But, you know, is it six debates that Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan have agreed to? This argument that there is not a debate dedicated to national security is something that the Ayotte campaign has been pushing for a number of days. I mean, you know, obviously it resonates with some voters, some who may be predisposed to favor Senator Ayotte. But, Paul, do you think that the absence of a standalone national security debate is something that most people are going to care about?
No, because I think national security is going to come up in each one of these six debates. I can say for sure right now in our NH1 News debate, we're going to be talking about it. So it is a storyline, Josh, as you said, that the Ayotte campaign wants to get out there because that's her wheelhouse. She's on the Armed Services Committee. She's on the Homeland Defense Committee as well. So it's a storyline she wants out there, and it is resonating with some voters.
And also, I just want to clarify, too, the debate that Keith mentioned, it's actually a forum where candidates would appear separately, so they wouldn't actually debate one another on the stage. And I believe that that's still being worked out, that may, in fact, come together at some point. But it wouldn't actually be a face-to-face debate. It would be one candidate comes up, then the other comes up.
Okay, why don't we go to the phones? We've got another call in from Mary from Tamworth. Mary, good morning.
Good morning. You got me eating my cereal. I have to swallow.
Go right ahead.
I just wanted to say that this term, the New Hampshire advantage, really, really gets me. I think it's the New Hampshire disadvantage because we have been starving our schools and starving New Hampshire in other ways, but the schools especially, and the schools in Carroll County where I live, are really in a demoralized state. They're really having a terrible time trying to figure out how to do their job with the money that they're offered. Teachers are very, very demoralized, and we are losing young families because the word has gotten out. Our education system is not good, and young families don't want to move to New Hampshire. We have a manpower problem, and also no one ever talks about taxes because that's such a kind of hot topic.
So but are you a Democrat?
I'm a Democrat, and we have people in our town who've lost their houses because of the way that the property tax works. Most people in New Hampshire don't know that houses can be seized from tax-delinquent families within 3 years, and there are many people in New Hampshire, poor people, who have lost their houses.
So are you excited to vote for Colin Van Ostern?
I am very excited to vote for Colin Van Ostern.
All right. Well, we'll see how it turns out 50 days away. Thanks for calling us. All right, we're coming up on the break now. We're going to be back to talk more politics and a few things that aren't political after the break. Do join us. The number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. Joined today by Allie Morris of the Concord Monitor, Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University. Let's turn to the Senate race, which, you know, despite the best efforts of the candidates, remains utterly nationalized. And, you know, the terror attacks last week brought a fresh round of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump questions. Paul, you were on hand to ask some of them after the Senate candidates had a form of AARP. What did you think of how they handled this round of questioning about the top of their ticket?
They're used to it. They are more than used to it. And, of course, I got a bunch of questions from myself and the other reporters on whether she thinks Donald Trump is, again, qualified to be commander-in-chief. And this was in the wake, of course, of the bombings in New York and New Jersey. And she knows just how to answer this now.
She knows very well how not to say his name. That's something she clearly tries to do. And Governor Hassan was a lot more affirmative about Hillary Clinton than she has been earlier as well. Dean, do you think that given just the world we're living in, given the flood of money coming into the race from national sources, we've got upwards of $50 million from outside money that they're just going to be kind of surfing the chop kicked up by all of these other voices in the race?
Yeah, it's certainly a possibility. I mean, to some extent, you see that anytime you're in a presidential year, you're always a little bit held hostage to whatever's going on at the top of the ticket. As I think Paul aptly stated, they're used to this by now, and they've been both Ayotte and Hassan have been talking about their respective presidential nominees for some time. They kind of know what the pitfalls are. They've each had their sort of moments where it hasn't gone quite the way they would have liked, and I think they've made some adjustments. It's interesting, there was this poll that came out from Monmouth University this week that has Hillary Clinton up 9 points over Donald Trump in New Hampshire, yet Kelly Ayotte +2 over Hassan. So it's interesting to me, to the extent that we know that Kelly Ayotte wants to disconnect her race from Donald Trump, this poll would suggest, at least for now, that she's having some success in doing that. That people may not be particularly high on Donald Trump as the nominee of the presidential aspect of the ticket, but they're looking at Kelly Ayotte as in a somewhat different light. And anytime you see those kind of poll numbers, they've got to feel like they're on the right track, even if it's essentially a dead heat. She could be much further down, given Trump's numbers.
Well, apart from not saying Donald Trump's name, Senator Ayotte's been doing a good job of campaigning in a manner that you wouldn't expect from Donald Trump, delivering UPS packages, hanging out at the transfer station to throw your trash away. Governor Hassan has been trying to also, appear local as well, drop-ins at Main Street businesses, occasionally kind of wooden photo shoots of her standing at a cash register next to a merchant, that kind of thing. But it has to be a struggle for both of them to sort of constantly affirm their their local credentials, running in such a sour atmosphere.
Yeah, Allie. Definitely. And I think, too, there's some debates coming up between the two of them. It starts next Friday, and then they'll begin to be televised. And I think that will be really interesting. Just, obviously they're being asked about Clinton and Trump separately. And then once they get on a stage together and can actually engage on this issue, I think it will be interesting to see what kinds of feelings, that susses out once they come together. They're both trying to connect with voters, and I think try to paint themselves as, just the local politician next door, as opposed to someone who's going to go to Washington and then get wrapped up in all the dysfunction, that's happening there.
Paul.
It was a big week for Social Security as well in the Senate race. Started Monday, there was a forum that AARP put on here in New Hampshire. And the theme here, obviously, is Hassan is trying to portray Ayotte as somebody who is trying to, we'll take your Social Security away, we'll privatize, and we'll also weaken Medicare. And it's obvious why, because seniors vote in higher percentages. They're going to be crucial, or could be crucial, in this November election.
I mean, that's a framing of this issue that is, very familiar to from past elections. I mean, one, the drug issue is something that is fresher, and it's interesting to see the response out of the continuing resolution funding that came out, yesterday out of Washington. And, Dean, the continuing resolution, I believe it would cover 10 weeks and, $37 million would be slotted in for CARER funding, which I guess translates to $7 million, which, depending on whether you're the incumbent or whether the challenger, you're going to be greeting that with differing degrees of enthusiasm.
Sure. And, Senator Ayotte and Senator Shaheen has also been very outspoken in pushing for additional appropriations for CARA and for opioid treatment and other types of programs related to the drug crisis. You know, I mean, part of running for senator or being a U.S. senator is talking about the extent to which you can bring federal tax dollars home to the state in order to help with whatever particular issue it is that your state is dealing with. So we're going to have, you know, I mean, there's just been this talk throughout the election that the opioid crisis has been too politicized. And I've said consistently that you have to talk about this issue in political terms because all solutions are either derived through state government or the federal government in the case of the Senate race. And those involve political compromises, as we've seen on a number of these bills. So, sure, it's you know, what senators can do to bring dollars home to deal with a crisis in New Hampshire is going to be a big part of any discussion of the issue, and that is inherently a political discussion.
Well, certainly one issue that Senator Ayotte faced is, you know, she was involved in passing CARA, as were pretty much everyone in the Senate,
right.
But she was put forward as you know, sort of a featured player by national Republicans. You know, Rob Portman was the lead Republican
Rob
author.
Portman's,
and he's, you know, obviously in a contested reelection as well, perhaps not as tight as this one. And one of the questions that these folks were being put to is like, okay, this is a great bill. It you know, is sweeping, but there's no money
attached.
There's no money,
right?
And, you know, when does the money hit the streets was a question that, you know, they were facing. And this allows them to say something. But it is interesting, Ayotte's response was, this is a positive step forward. You know, Senator Shaheen, who's obviously not on the ballot, says, you know, this is smoke and mirrors for Mitch McConnell. Governor Hassan was measured, saying she was, you know, pleased that there was some progress, but disappointed that there was not more. You know, it's still an open question to me is whether voters are going to say, oh, Washington failed to deliver up drug money, therefore I'm not going to vote for you know, Kelly Ayotte. I mean, are you hearing anything when you're out talking to voters on that front, Allie?
Not too much. And I think at the same time, you know, there's attacks being launched that are similar against Hassan by Republicans here that, you know, they approved all this new money in the state legislature and Republicans are saying that it's not getting out to communities fast enough. And I think, you know, I think for voters, when it really affects their pocketbook or they can see it in real life, it means much more to them. And I think, you know, making attacks about money coming slowly isn't necessarily tangible to voters and the first thing on their mind. I think what voters are most concerned about is, are things actually happening and are they moving forward? And I do think that when there is a debate over whether this bill actually does anything right now, that does turn voters off. You know, obviously, I think polls show that voters in you know, record lows in their views of how Congress is performing. And I think this bickering over whether a bill actually does what it says it's going to do is just one more, you know, potentially point for voters that Washington isn't working as it should.
All right. Voters out there, join us. It's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email at exchange@nhpr.org. Let's talk about another race for Congress, the first congressional district and developments in the first CD this week regarding Sean O'Connor. The Ballot Law Commission reaffirmed an earlier 4-1 vote to let him on the ballot as an independent. You know, Democrats put up quite a fight to keep him off. You know, good politics there, Dean, or overplayed, or doesn't really matter if they could keep him off. Good for them.
You know, we talked a little bit about this last week. It's hard to know at this point what kind of campaign O'Connor is going to be able to mount. I mean, he doesn't have particularly high name recognition, certainly not in comparison to Shea Porter and Ginta, who have, you know, will be meeting each other for the fourth time on Election Day. So, you know, he's still a big question mark. He's self-funding. You know, we don't really know that this is being driven by any kind of organic demand for a third-party candidate in that particular race. Yeah, I mean, going back a second time was probably a little bit much. I mean, they're just the larger problem just seems to be that there was a lack of clarity in terms of you know, whether or not you could sign more than one petition, and if you did sign more than one petition, how that should be dealt with administratively. Apparently, we're learning now there were sort of two versions of the petition. One didn't have any language. The other had sort of very sort of dense, complex language on the back of it. Is that sufficient? And I think the commission took all of this into account and said, you know, for purposes of this particular election and given what the options were, those signatures have to count and O'Connor will be on the ballot. You know, whether it's going to matter at all, really hard to say at this point.
Why don't we take a listen to what Sean O'Connor said after that hearing earlier this week?
You know, I mean, the party excluded me from their convention in 2016, and they did many other things to slate me along the way. I haven't filed legal action against them because, you know what, at the end of the day, I want the voters to decide this issue. I don't want this to be fought out in a courtroom. If they want to be petty and fight it out in a courtroom, we've done that twice now. I think they're losing credibility with the voters each and every day that we, you know, continue to have these ridiculous and frivolous court battles.
All right, that was Sean O'Connor speaking this week. And when he said courtroom, I think he meant Ballot Law Commission, which is you know, an adjudicated body that meets in the legislative office.
You listen to that sound, and he's got to be careful that he doesn't make this all about just sort of a personal, you know, a personal back and forth with particular members of the Democratic Party. I mean, he's going to have to actually sort of run a campaign and put out some sort of alternative vision of what he would do as a member of Congress. A lot of what I've heard from him so far has been people have treated me unfairly, they're out to get me, I'm not getting ballot access, et cetera. And he has every right to pursue that in the courts. But you also need to get on with a political campaign.
Paul. There is bad blood here, let's be honest. And that's what this is all
like
being
it.
Driven. He accused Carol Shea Porter back in the late winter and early spring of spreading false rumors about him. He threatened legal action against her, against the New Hampshire Democratic Party. Quit the party, now as an independent. They didn't want him on the ballot. And this could matter. This is going to be a very close election between Ginta and Shea Porter. If O'Connor siphons just a few thousand votes away from some progressives that he may support him. Remember, he backed Bernie Sanders, so there may be some progressives out there that go with him. It could be the difference.
Possible.
And I asked him after the hearing on Wednesday. I said, you know, what kind of campaign are you going to run? He said, you can expect to see TV, radio, direct mail. He's got the money to do it.
Well, that's,
see,
I mean,
if he doesn't.
I mean,
there's
something
the
about a rich guy who feels he's been wrong, who
exactly.
has
that's
no terribly deep
it,
ties
yes.
to the state, and you know, nothing to lose really, except possibly some cash. You know, that's not necessarily an adversary you want. And
bingo.
And to your point, it wouldn't necessarily take much, and particularly if you're appealing to Sanders voters, and you can say I'm, you know, one of you, and you know, you wouldn't need that many, and. You know, you can be sure that Frank Ginta is pleased to have him in the race as well.
Oh, extremely pleased. At the party breakfast, the GOP party unity breakfast,
he
kept
–
every 5 seconds he was mentioning I'm running against Carol Shea Porter and Sean O'Connor.
Well, and I think the other thing too, I mean, as you mentioned, Josh, this is the fourth matchup between Carol Shea Porter and Frank Ginta. And you've got to imagine some voters are just tired of that choice, which I think would potentially play well for Sean O'Connor.
All right. Why don't we go back to the phones? We have Maureen on the line from Exeter. Maureen, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is a wonderful program to teach me, a New Yorker new to New Hampshire, about the politics of the state since I won the vote in November.
All right.
But I had a question. One of the persons on your program said that they were happy that no matter who gets elected as governor, they were both tall and big, and so at least you know what your governor's going to look like. And I said, now—
Dean does have a type.
I never heard of such a thing. In other words, yeah, it was like what they're going to look of. They said they're tall and big, and so we at least know what they're going to look like. And I said, wait a minute, it's true I'm from New York. But I never heard such a thing, so I was curious to know why that enters into the conversation.
All right, well, I'll put Dean on the line here. Dean.
Great. It's a great question, Maureen, and I am also a former New Yorker. I've been here a little bit longer, but you will learn about the state very quickly, and I think you'll enjoy the politics here. You know, it was sort of half in jest, but to take it seriously for a moment, there's an extensive literature in political science and political psychology that looks at how people respond to physical cues. And there is, in a lot of people's mind, a certain sort of notion of what a leader looks like. You know, for many years when I was in grad school, we'd have these debates about, you know, is it always true that the taller guy is elected president or the guy with a certain look? And there is a lot of research that says that people respond to physical cues. So to the extent that these two gentlemen are sort of similarly sized, look very similar, in an odd way, it sort of takes out the sort of notion of how people respond to visual cues, whether it's, you know, gender-based or height-based. Or whatever dimension you want to talk about. So when I said it was oddly comforting, what I was referring to is the fact that it really removes the whole issue of sort of visual cues because they're just sort of very similar. I mean, they have different personalities, but there's a lot of research that shows that people respond viscerally to kind of physical appearance and stature and what they look like behind the podium. There are lots of sort of political psychologists who do sort of tests of showing people different versions of leaders and getting them to respond. So it was half joking, and I know both of these gentlemen, and it was meant in a, you know, sort of a positive jest. But on the other hand, it does literally remove that aspect of your decision-making process from the mix, right? Because they sort of you're going to respond to them in a physical way, I think, will be more similar than if they were very different people. So that's where that came from.
So Maureen, do you know how you're going to vote?
Well, I'm going to be voting for Mr. Van Ostern. I am a Democrat, but I think the explanation is useful, particularly since there's a lot of discussion about Hillary being a woman and how she's treated. And
absolutely,
the word
that's part
shrill,
of it. Yep.
So that does come forward in the national election. True.
And Trump's a big fellow.
Yep. All right, thanks for joining us. And let's go to another tightly contested and sometimes bitterly contested race that doesn't really get much public attention, which is the race for Speaker of the House. Sean Jasper, who, got in last time, with the help of Democrats, most in the Republican Party, the majority of the caucus did not support him. I'll throw this to Allie because she spends the most time in the State House these days. Will Sean Jasper, does he stand a good chance of getting the majority of Republicans should, when it comes time for them to choose?
Yeah. So I think it's first important to note that, this race will only be viable if Republicans take the House.
Sure.
And when Speaker Sean Jasper made it official this week announcing that he will seek a second term as Speaker, he pointed out that the House tends to flip back and forth every 2 years. But should he, should Republicans take the House, it's shaping up to be an interesting race. It's Sean Jasper, and then we have Bedford Representative Lori Sanborn. She jumped in earlier this summer, and she had actually run at the start of last session but dropped out, citing her husband's health issues. And we also have Carol McGuire, who recently jumped in. She's more libertarian-leaning, moved here as part of the Free State Project. And, in a three-way race, I think it is pretty interesting. Both McGuire and Lori Sanborn have basically said Sean Jasper is not conservative enough. He doesn't represent Republican ideals. And they mostly point to a vote on expanded Medicaid. Sean Jasper actually broke a key tie vote as this bill was moving through the legislature, one of the few votes he took as Speaker. And that miffed a lot of Republicans who really hate expanded Medicaid. This issue was, most tightly contested among the GOP. Democrats are generally on board with the program. I think that's one of his big challenges. But I think a lot of Republicans and House members kind of respected the way that he ran the House. He tried to let committees do their own work and take their recommendations, which is a way that I think some of the long-term members of the House appreciate it being run instead of kind of a top-down, you must follow our party platform.
Yes, and you're right. That will, the speakership tends to depend on which side takes a majority. And, to Dean's earlier observation, it's worth noting that Steve Shurtleff, the House Minority Leader, and Sean Jasper also look somewhat similar. So we'll be back after the break with more Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. As always, join us. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477 or email at exchange@nhpr.org. This week we have Paul Steinhauser, NH1, Allie Morris, Concord Monitor, Dean Spiliotis, Southern New Hampshire University, and on the phone we have Steve from Nottingham. Steve, good morning.
Good morning. It's an easy question. As a senior citizen, I am concerned about the property tax being very oppressive. And why is it not even considered now a state income tax? Except from Jackie Sully a couple of election ago, nobody even mentions this. When the lower club brings it up to the candidates, they all say no, 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 no. It's not even talked about.
All right, loud and clear, Steve. Classic question. Why don't candidates for governor talk about the income tax? You're right that Jackie Sillie, when she ran a few years ago, she didn't say she was actually for an income tax. She said she would not take the pledge to veto a broad-based sales or income tax. You know, Dean, I'll put this to you as a political scientist. Is this just about simple winning elections?
Yeah, I think there is a fair bit of strategy there. It goes back to our earlier discussion about Chris Sununu's comments on the New Hampshire advantage. It's a big component of that. It's interesting, you know, having moved here from other parts of the country where I paid state tax. In one case, I even paid a city tax on certain things. And you come here, and it's just part of the ethos. And I find increasingly people who move here from other states, after a few years, they start to buy into the idea of no sales. They like telling other people, we have no sales tax, we have no income tax. It becomes part of your selling of the state. And I think candidates realize that it is just sort of embedded in our culture. And the empirical record for people who have supported an income tax has not been good politically. So I think that is a strategic decision. I think some people, you know, for some people it's an economic decision, for others it's strategic. But the caller is absolutely right that property taxes, particularly on retired individuals on fixed incomes, can be brutal. And that's just sort of the reality of way the sort of downshifting of costs.
And that issue of older people on fixed incomes, I mean, that was like a main point that the last person to run on an income tax, Mark Fernald, used to make. He used to talk about how he volunteered helping somebody, a neighbor, do their taxes and how they were struggling to stay in his house. And, you know, there are certainly other factors in play in that race, but, you know, he lost by a whopping margin to Craig Benson in 2002. Paul?
The Democratic gubernatorial primary that we just had, it was a race to the left with all three candidates trying to prove they were the most liberal, most progressive. But even with all that in mind, none of them ever considered raising either the property tax, the sales tax or income tax.
Well, yeah. I mean, it is the recipe for Democrats has been, try to be as fiscally conservative as the Republican and be more socially liberal. That is what has worked, Allie.
But, you know, I think the caller brings up a good point. And I think it's a question that candidates are going to have to continue grappling with, and even more so. I mean, there was a report that came out this week from the Office of Energy and Planning that showed, you know, the state's population 65 and older is going to double between now and 2040. Meanwhile, the people under age 15 is shrinking. And, you know, I think that's a huge cost coming that the state is going to have to deal with. And candidates really aren't outlining how they're going to pay for that and how they are dealing with an aging state where young people are continually leaving and not kind of repopulating that part of the population.
All right, Steve, thanks for the call. And, you know, we're going to turn from politics in a minute, but let's just look forward to the weekend. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of campaigning going on here. U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts is going to be up here from Democrat, sort of, you know, fresh off her performance with the Wells Fargo executive that was very big for Democrats on social media. And meanwhile, in Loudoun, stock car legend Richard Petty will be feting Trump supporters at the track. You know, I'm not sure you could find two people representative of different cultural constituencies as Elizabeth Warren and Richard Petty. You know, is that just a sign of the polarization of our politics, Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you want to bring out people who are going to be a draw for a particular group of voters. And I think that really encapsulates it quite nicely. You know, we've seen this for many years at the presidential level where you often find Republican candidates there. They use a lot of country and Western music because they draw a lot of support from the South and from that community. It's the same idea. You know, NASCAR, what have you, or Elizabeth Warren for progressives. Yeah, you want somebody who's going to be a draw, whether it's a politician or a musician or an athlete, where people get excited to come out and see that person, and then maybe in the process they'll learn something more about the candidate. Sure.
I mean, somebody emailed me and said, you know, this is a Republican emailed me and said, oh, you know, they got to bring up Elizabeth Warren. Like, they must be worried about their base. And, you know, there are concerns that Hillary Clinton is the excitement gap. But, I mean, do you think there's anything to that, Allie?
I mean, I do. You know, we saw Elizabeth Warren, she's obviously tied to Bernie Sanders, who, you know, very clearly won the primary race here by a huge margin over Hillary Clinton. And I do think, I mean, they're going to the University of New Hampshire. Obviously, young voters played a huge role in helping Bernie Sanders win the primary here. And I think that is a group that they have to get excited about voting. You know, in a year when Donald Trump maybe revving up some voters who hadn't necessarily come to the polls very often before, I think the millennial student vote could be key for, you know, Maggie Hassan and Hillary Clinton here in the state.
And the degree to make sure that that those folks don't gravitate towards, you know, Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, and there's some polling indicating that, you know, some of that is happening, and any leeching of that is certainly something that Democrats are going to be concerned about. But why don't we move to away from politics for a minute? There's still politics in this, but to you know, state staffing issues and controversies involving New Hampshire Hospital and DCYF. You know, the $36 million contract with Dartmouth-Hitchcock to staff New Hampshire Hospital, New Hampshire's state hospital, was again before the Executive Council this week, as was Dartmouth-Hitchcock CEO Dr. James Weinstein. I wasn't there to watch it myself, but based on the news accounts, you know, as reported in your paper, Allie, Dr. Weinstein had very little to say of substance about, you know, either the contract or the layoffs at Dartmouth-Hitchcock, which, you know, could number 400. I mean, what did you make of that?
Yeah, well, you know, it's all been kind of a whirlwind and I think just a case of terrible timing. You know, obviously, the Executive Council approved this major contract for Dartmouth-Hitchcock to basically manage psychiatric care at New Hampshire Hospital. And that came, you know, after weeks of delays over concerns with the labor dispute and staffing levels. And then 2 days after the Executive Council approved this, Dartmouth-Hitchcock announced that they would be making these huge layoffs by the end of the year, which I think caught a lot of executive counselors and state officials by surprise. And then, you know, it came out recently that the chief medical officer at New Hampshire Hospital is going to be leaving. It's not clear whether that's related to the layoffs. And, you know, I think that the state is sort of looking for assurances here. And what the CEO of Dartmouth-Hitchcock has said is that these layoffs will not affect New Hampshire Hospital, but he's been unable to articulate who they will affect, which I think still is leaving some with a sour taste in their mouth. That if you are assuring that it won't affect these people, who will it affect? Could it potentially affect people here? I think another question is, in this labor dispute, some of the New Hampshire Hospital psychiatrists who left because they said Dartmouth-Hitchcock was unwilling to negotiate employment terms, I think some of the counselors are wondering, you know, is that a red flag about other staff? Will Dartmouth-Hitchcock be able to retain enough workers to actually fill the slots at New Hampshire Hospital, which they say they have? So I think there's still a lot of uncertainty among the executive counselors, and Kristen Nuno actually asked for the contract to be rebid. And I think going forward, we'll see how this shakes out.
So you were at the meeting, weren't you, Paul?
Yeah, there was some great political theater because, A, this was the first council meeting since what happened. It was the first council meeting since Van Ostrand and Sununu won their primaries, and they're sitting right next to across from each other. And Sununu, yeah, he was very, very vocal about this.
But he did stop short of making a formal motion to reconsider,
no
which
formal
he,
motion.
He would have known it would have failed, I
right.
guess.
Right, he doesn't have the votes. Yeah. He doesn't even have the Republican votes to help him. So, and Collins' kind of take was, let's wait and see. You know, we do need to think about alternatives, but let's wait and see what actually happens. Sununu definitely calling for action, but there will be no action right now.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
State Republican Party is certainly trying to sort of stoke this. I mean, with the potential, I mean, they'd be happy if it hurts Governor Hassan. They'd be happy if it sort of undermines Colin Van Ostern.
They want to get a twofer out of
yes.
it. Yeah.
And so they've FOIA'd this, that, and the other. And, you know, Dean, do you think this is, you know, this is complicated? There are few facts known right now. You know, do you think this is, you know, going to persist as an issue, or this is just,
you know, it'll pop up. I think now and again. I mean, when we see these layoffs go into full effect, there may be additional reporting and stories, so it may come up again. It is interesting and framed in the context of the first executive council meeting since the primaries. But I think Jeff Myers, who's the head of New Hampshire Health and Human Services, I mean, he really laid out the bottom line, which is there are no other bidders. I mean, DHMC is really kind of the only game in town. So I think, as Allie said, the best thing that they can do is put pressure, you know, keep monitoring. I think DHMC is going to give weekly public updates on staffing.
They're very transparent. Yeah. In fact, they gave us the reporters yeah. there at the hearing a list that I showed yeah. every employee every week, and they're going to do this week by week by week.
Yeah, and there was, you know, I recall when they first switched over and started, there was a concern about the staffing at the New Hampshire Hospital, that they had closed some beds up at the Lebanon facility. And so those are the kinds of things I think that the council will stay on top of. It's not clear to me what the alternative is other than to monitor it closely.
All right. Another issue involving state staffing was the DCYF and an RFP that for a hotline you know, apparently received no bidders. And, you know, there were complaints about the RFP Dartmouth. You know, Jeff Myers says that Dartmouth-Hitchcock was the only game in town. At certain points, Chris Sununu has indicated that he believed the RFP was written in such a way that it would have if not explicitly excluded, would have been a deterrent for other bidders to get in on that. I don't know if that's if there's much there, but you know the fact is this RFP at Department of Children and Family Services for to get a vendor to staff this hotline after four Monday through Friday, you report child abuse, you get an answering machine. You know, in both cases, this comes as out of a legislative task force that was looking into DCYF after deaths of two children that were had contact with the system. You know, Allie, this is something that's obviously a great frustration to lawmakers.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I think a lot of people were surprised to hear that DCYF doesn't have 24-hour staffing, that if you want to call and make a complaint of child abuse on the weekend, there's not someone at the answering machine. You have to call the police. And these hearings that this commission had were pretty alarming. They revealed some concerning trends about DCYF. And I think, you know, people at the department are frustrated. I think this comes down to potentially spending more money. Initially, DCYF had wanted to staff nights and weekends with existing employees, but the director of the division there said that would not be possible given the existing department budget. And obviously this RFP didn't attract any bidders. And so I think lawmakers will have to go back to the drawing board and say, do we need to overhaul the system? Do we need to spend more money? Which is obviously not something that Republicans generally favor.
I'm sure this will come up in the budget once the new governor has a whack at that. So let's turn to one other big issue pending in the state government, and that's before the New Hampshire Supreme Court, which is involves New Hampshire's rape shield law and the Seth Mazalia appeal. He was, you know, convicted of murder and got life without parole for strangling UNH student Lizzie Marriott back in 2012. And at issue there is whether or not Marriott's sexual past will be allowed in during the appeals process. New Hampshire's rape shield law forbid that information from being introduced at trial. You know, it pits fundamental interests, which is the privacy of a victim versus a defendant's right to a fair trial. And, you know, people close to this issue say whatever the court decides could have repercussions that would extend well beyond New Hampshire. Dean?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you laid it out very clearly. The issue is that, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of this law that was adopted in 75 is that, you know, it's not applicable for the trial, but apparently it's different for an appellate proceeding. And I think that Mazalia's lawyers want to argue probably that her prior sexual history in some way feeds into the activities they were engaged in that night when she was killed. It's going to go to the New Hampshire Supreme Court. They heard it on. I think they heard the arguments on Wednesday. And you're right. There's a lot of interest here, not only among victims' rights groups here in the state, but I think nationally it could have implications as well.
Well, why don't we hear what Lynn Chalet, who's the executive director of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence, had to say outside the Supreme Court earlier this week.
Were New Hampshire Supreme Court to strip away these protections on appeal, we would become the only state in the country to do this. By doing so, the Supreme Court would undo 40 years of settled case law that says that victims deserve privacy and protections in the court system. These protections are designed to apply both at the trial court level and on appeal. If these protections are stripped away, we return to the dialogue we were having about rape victims in the 1970s.
Okay, that was Lynn Chalet of the New Hampshire Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence outside the Supreme Court earlier this week. I mean, one thing that's interesting about this case is that it was caused by an administrative rule change earlier this year that the court adopted to allow appellate judges to open records sealed by lower courts. And it's actually sort of retroactive in the case of Seth Mazalia. And you know, this caused a huge storm of prosecutors, advocates, and the court said they were going to kind of go slow and how they, you know, whatever they determine. I mean, this has a lot of people stirred up, and it, I don't know, no matter what happens, this is a big deal.
Yeah, and I think depending on what the outcome is, lawmakers may take a look at this too in the coming session. As you mentioned, when this first came out, there was immediately a huge press conference. Governor Hassan spoke out against the decision.
Senator
Attorney
Ayotte.
General Foster, Senator
yeah.
Ayotte. You know, there was a huge outpouring of anger about this decision. And I think, you know, the legislature might keep an eye on this depending on how the court rules.
All right. It's that time of the show. What are you all going to be keeping your eye on next week? Paul?
Debates. I'll be down at Hofstra University in New York on Monday for the presidential debate, and I'll end the week up at North Conway for the first Senate debate in our blockbuster Senate battle.
All right. Allie?
Yeah, that's exactly it. At the debate up in Conway, we'll see our candidates face off for the first time.
And Dean?
Same here. I'm having trouble fitting all this stuff on my iPhone calendar, trying to keep the next month straight, given how many different forums and debates there are going to be. But it's a great opportunity for voters who are interested to really learn about these candidates. And I think we'll see polls move in one direction or the other as people learn more.
All right. There does remain paper and pen, Dean. You can write it down.
That is true.
This is the Weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Josh Rogers. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to panelists Paul Steinhauser, Allie Morris, Dean Spiliotis. Have a good weekend, everybody.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.